Welcome to a Wonder Junkie podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Anderson. Today I'm speaking with Barbara Joy. And she's a very unique person that I met about a year ago at a woman named Jody's house. And it was at a private little gathering with some live music. And Jody is quite a unique person who brings a lot of interesting people together. And she's devoted her life to service. And that's where I met Barbara. And I'd actually like to get to know Jody, too. She's going to be someone that I'd like to have on the podcast eventually. So we get to talking at this little gathering, and Barbara and I immediately hit it off. She has a big heart, and she's lived quite an interesting life. She was granted a certificate of thanatology in 2003, and in 2005 from the Association of Death Education and Counseling. She is certified by Grief Recovery Institute and offers grief recovery outreach programs and seminars. She is certified since 1996 in transpersonal psychology and holotropic breathwork from the Groff Transpersonal Institute. Barbara completed the East-West Psychology PhD program at the California Institute of Integral Studies, specializing in methods and systems of transformation. She is a lifelong student of culture and religion, completing 10 years of university study in the ancient wisdom teachings, including shamanism. Barbara has so much to say, but we only had an hour and a half together, so we did our best to get into some of her essence of who she is and what she's done while she's been on the planet. Barbara is an interesting person, and I'm so grateful to know her, and I'm sure there's going to be many more conversations and a lot that I can learn from her throughout my life, so this is just the beginning, and I wanted to have her on the podcast to share some of her wisdom with you. So enjoy the ride and enjoy the conversation. Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for connecting with me and for doing this little conversation recorded. It's an honor to be here with you.
It's an honor to be in your sacred space with you as well.
Thank you. So I guess for the people that are going to be listening, I'll just help them understand how we met.
Great.
Jody's house. Can you describe who Jody is so people can understand how we met? Because she seems cool enough to even bring an intro into.
Yes, I've known Jody, I don't know how many years I was introduced to her, but Jody is the giving angel on the planet. She is a giving heart, a beautiful soul. And she draws people to her and makes connections like nobody's business.
That's what everyone there said. My friend John, who you're friends
yes.
with, he brought me there and it was just like, whoa, this place is a Zen garden. And you knew right when you walked in that all the people there were interesting. And that's where I met you the first time I went there. She does these beautiful Sunday, once a month, it seems, special events where she has a musician that she knows come and perform in her little beautiful backyard or in the house, and 20 or 30 people come. I think they donate some money if they want.
Yes.
Everyone breaks bread together. It's like a potluck.
It's a tribe. It's definitely
incredible.
A tribe.
Yeah, that was probably one of the coolest events I've ever been to. And then she had me introduce myself to the group, and you overheard me talk about a little breath work, and we connected, and I think the initial conversation ended up being an hour because we had such a deep, easy time connecting.
So yes.
We were fast friends, and it was nice. I came over to your house one time and we had tea, and you got to show me all your beautiful holotropic breathwork paintings. And I have a beautiful introduction to breathwork from Stan Groff myself years after you were already following him around like a puppy dog. It sounds like you guys were deeply close.
We were.
So can you just, let's start there. I'm curious because I didn't really get to hear a lot of your connection to Stan Groff. And how did you even get into that field? Go wherever you want with that. But I'm curious how you even met Stan Groff.
Well, I had been involved already in personal growth trainings. I had been involved in dream work from childhood, thanks to my dad, who was a great sharer of dreams as soon as I could talk.
Cool.
We talked about the universe. We talked about God. And so expansion of consciousness was how I chose, I believe, to come into this world and choose a father that would support that.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So, you know, through my life, I have pursued studies in many, many areas, culture and religion, dream work. I read about Stan long before I knew about breathwork, holotropic breathwork, long before I met him, and never thought I would in my lifetime.
Wow.
But it was in the 1990, I went back to ASU to go to get my degree in clinical counseling. And in my very first class, I met a beautiful angel by the name of Ruth Rees, and she talked about dreams. And in the first class...
I'm going to fix your mic just so we hear you. There you go.
There we go.
Yeah.
Talked about dreams in our first class, my first day of my first class at ASU in counseling.
Beautiful.
And afterwards, I stopped to talk to her. And we talked for like 3 hours. And it was one of those, again, beautiful connections and synchronicities. And she said to me then, she said, Barbara, she didn't even know me. She said, when you graduate, you have to go to California to go to school. There's a school there that I know that you have to go to. Well, 3 years later, I was graduating from ASU. And my two supervisors, two great guys, mm-hmm. Ericksonian hypnotherapists that worked in the Valley at that time, and I had gotten very close to them around hypnosis, and on the side, they taught me what I needed to know about hypnosis, which was just an extension of all the things I'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they sat there my last session with them and said, Barbara, you have to go to California to go to school. There's a program there called East-West Psychology, and you have to go. And I'd broken my arm, and I was in a cast like this. Mm-hmm. So I was taking the bus. And I don't know if you know the story when you were a kid of the little train that could.
Oh, yeah.
So at the time, I was a single mom, and my son was 12 years old, and I had been his sole parent from the time he was a year old.
Wow. So you had him young. Very young.
No, he was my second.
Oh, wow.
Yes. He's 12 years younger than my daughter.
Wow.
Yes. Amazing. So it was my second marriage that I had him. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I've got this, you know. But I'm on my way like this to the bus with the cast, you know. And I'm on my way and I'm like, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm walking to the bus stop, you know, a little later, like, oh my God, what would it be? By the time I got on the bus, it was like, you're doing it.
Beautiful.
And Spirit provided an opportunity because my son, who had been separated from his dad since he was a year old, mm-hmm. and his dad lived in North Carolina, wanted to go live with his dad.
Beautiful.
And so he left, and I had the opportunity to go.
Wow.
And
in that exact timing.
That time and those moments, that the time that I was there, was the most incredible time of my life.
What was that school? Did he create that school?
Or no.
Was that just tell me about that
Alan
school.
Watts and Aurobindo. Okay. These were the energies at the time.
Uh-huh.
It's the California Institute of Integral Studies.
Okay.
And at the time, they had a East-West psychology PhD program that was one of a kind in the world.
Wow. That's amazing.
The hearts and minds and souls that came there to teach.
Yeah. Like the Jack Kornfields, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Although Jack had his own center and still does up in Northern California.
Can you think of any bigger names that people would recognize? I'm sure there's a ton, but just, was even like Jon Kabat-Zinn a part of any of that? Or
He was not that I know of in my time, but Brian Swim, Cosmology, David Ulansey, who solved the Mithraic mysteries in his dissertation through an error in astrology.
Pretty crazy.
Oh my gosh. Angels Arian, beautiful men and women who came. One beautiful professor who started Chinese professor, and then they say their name. It's either Wee Wu or Wu Wee, and I don't know which goes which, but beautiful man came to teach I Ching. Now, he had started the first Chinese studies in China.
Wow, that's incredible.
And when he came, and we're all in I Ching, and we're all so, he was such a little tiny, beautiful, like elder.
Yeah.
And we're like, when you came to America, did you throw the sticks? And he looked at us and he goes, I have 5 children. I had to ask my wife if she wanted to move. And I mean, the humanity of that.
Yeah.
Stan Krippner.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful soul who introduced me to Rollo May.
Amazing. How many years was the program?
I was there. I completed my proposal. It took me 3.5 years. And I moved back to Phoenix then to write my dissertation. That turned out to be another host story, which would take another hour and a half
to share. Well, there's a lot of learning that you've spent your life doing.
But when I was there, Rick Tarnas, so he's like the world's transit astrologer. Amazing. And so, I couldn't even begin.
At that age, how old were you about that time? Do you know?
Yes, I was in my 40s.
Cool.
I was 47 when I went there, I believe.
Because you had already been through this huge chapter of single motherhood and
5 years of first staffing, then facilitating Omega, which is still my heart, my incredible relationship with George Dare. He started a study group that I participated in for 3 years in the ancient teachings.
Cool.
Then he created a master's program that was taken on by Westbrook University, which used to be in Glendale. I was its first student.
Amazing.
So I went through and completed a program, 5 years of study in the ancient teachings.
Wow. What was your underlying driver of all the seeking and curiosity and expansion of consciousness? What do you think was driving you? Because I know it was always of service, and we've gotten into it in other conversations, but to try to unpack you and your life is almost impossible. But I've always heard from you like you've wanted to give and create offerings for people and to help them minimize suffering. So I'm just curious, like, what was driving it at the time, or did it shift throughout time?
I think I want to go back to the energy of the time that I was born, because transit is, I mean, the astrological influences are profound. So my father, who was short in stature, was in the Air Force for World War II. He was a turret gunner. He sat in the bubble.
Wow.
In a glass bubble. And that's where he was while the rest of his team was inside the plane.
Oh my gosh. I just watched a series on this.
He was a sharpshooter. He was a master sharpshooter.
What a dangerous place to be, though.
Yes.
The bottom like that.
Yes. So I have a brother, or had a brother. He's deceased now, but he was born right after my father went into the war. He's born in 43. And my mother went back to live with her parents, where she was the darling. She was the darling of her family.
Mm-hmm.
She was newly married and young to my dad, who's 4 years older, and already in the service when she met him.
Wow.
So my dad came back in July for a leave in 1945, and I was conceived on the beach. I know this.
Amazing.
That they know this.
Yeah.
I was conceived on the beach. That's why I love the water so much. In July of 1945, about 2 weeks later, give or take,
yeah,
they dropped the bomb.
Yeah, right in the middle of it all.
So I came energetically into this time. When my father returned in December or January, when the war was over,
mm-hmm.
he came home to a three-year-old son that he did not know and did not know him. He came back to a wife who he didn't know, and she did not know him.
Right.
And that started the family. I was the hope and the golden child and the golden energy to each member of my family in their own way. And I knew that. I knew my place. And each one wanted me to care for them and provide something that they didn't have.
Wow. At what age can you remember, before you got into learning about your past, how young do you remember feeling like you were there to sort of be that person in people's world?
As far back as my consciousness goes.
Wow.
Because I received verbal messages from each one of these, my brother, mm-hmm. my father, and my mother, that told me what I was to do.
Wow. Interesting.
And they were very strong messages
yeah.
that when I was a child, there were times it was almost horrifying to me.
Yeah.
But I later came to discover that that was my superpower.
Amazing.
So I transformed that through experience and spirit.
Yeah.
Those messages.
How cool.
Yeah.
Had to be tough in your teenage years and stuff when you're trying to figure yourself out and wonder, like the alien conversation we had where you started to read and find out that you weren't alone in the world, thinking and having these existential experiences. And you started to discover the books and authors that,
yes.
oh, I'm not alone. Tell me a little about that, because that's fascinating to me.
Well, I had visions in the crib. I probably, you know, today could get burned at the stake for that. No, but I
10 years
not
ago.
10 years ago, I had visions in the crib.
Yeah.
I also had these conversations with my dad. Now, one of my favorite stories, and I don't remember it specifically, but I could feel the energy of it. My dad always said, because we talked about dreams. We'd get up in the morning and we would share our dreams as soon as I could talk. And he would share his dreams. We'd talk about the universe and God. And I had the books that we had were like Rumi. And,
wow.
Yeah.
That was from his side. Like he came in with that.
He came in with
wow.
that. Classical music. My mother was a dancer. We had music and dance.
Was he young? Like when you were... When he was your father?
He was 29 when I was born.
To be into those fields of interest at a young age, you know, and
yes.
to be in the
he
war.
He was quite the Renaissance.
He had to be an interesting guy.
He was unbelievable. He was an inventor and an artist, a musician.
Wow.
He had a dark side, too.
Sure.
I thought he was God.
Yeah.
When I was young.
Well, and then going
Light
to
and
the
dark.
War and who knows too much, how much
yeah.
is.
But, so... The story he says is that when I was 3 years old, he says three, that we were having a discussion of God, about God and the universe. And I told him that I thought all of the world and all of the people were in a teardrop in God's eye.
Wow. That's amazing insight.
So this is one of my favorite stories because it's a theme that carried forward that revealed itself later and later on. And I'd like to share that
Please.
Revelation
yeah.
with you.
Yeah.
So I remember that story and I could picture it. I could picture like the eye of God. Now you have to remember this is 1940, 9?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The eye of God with a teardrop, and all of the people are in the teardrop, in the drop.
It's amazing.
Fast forward to the Hubble telescope. And what did the Hubble telescope discover?
That long view of the galaxies. And
the nebulae, which is named the Eye of God.
Beautiful, yeah.
And there's pictures of it. I was so drawn to that, although I didn't tie it into the story at that time when the Hubble telescope discovered it. But in 2015, when I was taking a class in the Foundations of Science of Mind, we had to do a project. And I chose the project of tying in the story because I just somehow, when I started to write and prepare for the final presentation, mm-hmm. I put together this whole thing about the Eye of God with the Hubble telescope picture, which I have on my phone and my house.
Yeah, I remember you showed me that.
Yes. And it's always been like, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing this story and I decide to look up who's the astronomer that discovered, or one of them that discovered it in the telescope.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing research on Google, and the name of the person, one of the names, is a woman. I can't remember her first name. I think it's Janet.
Yeah.
But I'm doing this research, and I'm writing down this name, and this is what I write. Say it's Janet. I don't know. Allman. Allman. All of mankind
mm-hmm.
is in the eye of God.
That's cool.
And that was like an explosion.
Yeah.
Inside of me when that all came full circle.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. I love hearing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Especially when you're 3 or 4 having that existential
yes.
awareness, but not knowing that it's even weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that time you had a good dad that was open-minded and
yes.
allowing you to sort of cultivate that. Whereas a lot of kids probably come through, most kids, their consciousness is so open and curious, but stunted by the culture. Mm-hmm. Or shunned or demonized or repressed mm-hmm. or, you know, that's nonsense.
What about you? Did you early on come to some?
You know, it's hard. I actually have a different memory of being young, but I have had, when I was little, I grew up Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So my first relationships to God were through the language of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked for me. I was lucky. I look back at all the benefit it served for me, and I remember having a deep prayer every night and always feeling connected to a higher power and feeling good about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm adopted, so I remember feeling lucky and always praying to God and having this incredible, it was like just gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And that's carried through my whole life as gratitude, as like the ultimate prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a state, so it's an experience. And I feel like when I was little, I remember having that as my big thing. And I never zoomed out and saw space or consciousness on those mm-hmm. kind of scales, I don't mm-hmm. think. But maybe because of the indoctrination of the limiting stories of what the Garden of Eden and the stories I was given were creating the relationship existentially that I was having, if that makes sense. Whereas yours was roomy in these different realms. So you were giving your imagination and your consciousness a different way of, and I don't know how it works, but I believe that my initial experiences were not driven by that way until I started reading books about space mm-hmm. and floating in tanks mm-hmm. and meditating and books and all the stuff later, which then unlocked and helps you to remember, I think,
yes,
those components of mm-hmm. our true nature
mm-hmm.
and access to those spaces. But I think belief systems are jammy and they're like helmets. I always picture like you're wearing a helmet that prevents your antenna from transmitting and receiving whatever consciousness is. And certain belief systems are a little more blocky than mm-hmm. others. There are tighter helmets and some mm-hmm. are more web-like and you can let certain things in and out.
Mm-hmm.
So as I've gotten older, I've trimmed a lot of my belief systems away, which now I can have access to someone like yours mind and not shut it down and go, well, mm-hmm. that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to. I used to have it in there. Where mm-hmm. I was like, oh, come on. Really? But, you know, you start to have experiences and there's so much unlocking and remembering that you're like, oh, actually, we don't know what consciousness is. This is a mystery. So, yeah, I didn't have a lot of young, crazy existential experiences. It was mostly deep prayer and a more local linear mm-hmm. model of God. Mm-hmm. So when I blew my mind open, it was fast and explosive. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't easy to land the plane. But it also started a really good fire. And it turned into exponential learning and, to me, growth and expansion of consciousness that now is a little more subtle and controlled. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, it was a fast flame and it
yes.
was almost dangerous.
Yes.
And I've seen it happen to people now. And I'm a lot more conservative with my approach when it comes to telling others how this stuff works, whether it be Absolutely. Breath work or plant medicines or even certain books. Maybe mm-hmm. you shouldn't read a book about the Holocaust if it's going to destabilize your... It just depends on the person and where they're at. And mm-hmm. so I'm like, hey, sometimes it's not always a good idea to go blow your consciousness open too fast.
Absolutely.
I think you know that more than anyone.
I mean, to me, the safe container is... And that's hugely what I learned in Omega as well, you know, is to have a place where you can be held safely.
An anchor.
Yes.
A good home uh-huh. base.
Yes.
A garden.
And whatever. Of course, Stan, you know, going through, I 4 years I trained with him. And
was that in the 90s or?
It was from 93 through 96.
And you were in after. California training mm-hmm. with him at, where yes. was that?
At the California Institute of Integral Study.
Yep.
So I had read about breath work. I knew people in Arizona that did breath work. When I went to California, Stan was on the faculty mm-hmm. of the school. I got a job in the registrar's office. So I was in touch with every professor because I was in charge of grades. It's a small school, only 1,200 students.
Wow.
Amazing environment. It was in a church school, and it was one block from Haight-Ashbury.
Wow.
And Jerry Garcia's house was right across the street from us, and he died right after I got there, and we had altars in every floor of this church school. Oh my gosh, it was phenomenal. All that energy. Oh,
it's like that leftover energy of the 60s yes. that transpired into the people that lived through it, survived it, and then came through with a little bit of lessons from what went off the rails and didn't work to like, hey, let's ground this plane and, you know, that was a really interesting time.
It was so amazing because there was no distinction between student and teacher. We were all there together. Whatever the name was or the history of whoever that person was, Stan, you know, anybody. We sometimes had classes in their home.
It's amazing.
We would sit, Stan Krippner. What a beautiful soul. He was like a grandpa in the best way, even though he wasn't that much older than me.
Yeah.
But we would, the very first class in my very first course was the psychology of shamanism.
Wow.
And he and Jürgen Kramer co-taught that class. And we would all sit on the floor in a circle, not a large group of people. And we did, we went to Sweat Lodge. I had also, at the time I was part of Omega, I also was attending Sweat Lodge for 2 years. That was my spiritual practice was Sweat wow. Lodge. Here in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
But Jürgen was like this beautiful storyteller. He had been in an accident. He had hurt his foot, so he had to sit in a chair, and we all sat around him. And it was kind of like kindergarten, where you're sitting around, leaning up against the leg of your teacher, just like, oh, just tell me the story.
Yeah.
And he would tell the story.
How cool.
He was so beautiful.
Yeah. What a non-traditional, beautiful way to transfer knowledge. The old way?
Yes.
You know?
And every single class was like that.
That's cool.
Every one of them. There was no distinction. We were there together to ride the wave. We were there together to learn from each other. There was no formality. It was just a beautiful, we would pray, meditate. We would, you know, we had altars, we lit candles, we smudged, and this was every class.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
And when you came out of that, were you then teaching what you had learned already, or had you been starting to integrate it into some form of service?
I had already, my whole life up to that point, because I was 50 when I left there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I took all of that and then moved forward into thanatology, the field of thanatology, where I took all that spiritual culture, religion, dreams, all those methods of transformation.
Yeah.
And I went to serve in the field of death, dying, grief, loss, and bereavement.
Wow. And did you ever see yourself going that trajectory, or did it present itself?
Oh, I that was of my heart.
Cool. So you knew you were aiming at that.
Even as a little girl, I knew I was aiming for that.
And just helping people, like, in a different way than the traditional hospice way. Or was hospice even around at that point?
Well,
it was, right?
Yes. Oh, yes.
And so that's where you went. It was like, let's be a part of this.
I wanted to be in hospice, but when I first moved back, I wasn't able to secure a position. Mm-hmm. So I volunteered for hospice. But in the meantime, I wrote a proposal to create a community outreach center for bereavement services.
Wow.
And I went to the regional manager of a corporation called SCI, Service Corporation International. They're the largest funeral service corporation in the world.
Wow.
And in the Valley at that time, they had 26 mortuaries and cemeteries. So I went to the regional manager with my proposal and said, this is what I want you to do. I want to do this, and I want you to sponsor me. Mm. Well, that took about 3 months of negotiation.
Yeah.
We each gave at the end, and it was created through joint effort. It turned out to be a phenomenon.
Wow.
Because of the energy of allowing anyone in the community to come. They didn't have to be a client. They didn't have to have used the facilities.
Wow.
And I, there was so much that happened from there. In-service trainings, groups. I worked with all the hospitals. I worked with all the nonprofits. I worked in the schools.
Wow.
I ran groups. In-service trainings and City of Phoenix. I mean, there was so much information that needed to be given out.
Yeah. It's like, and you needed a billion more people to help. But they probably started coming, and then you started seeing all the connections.
Oh, yeah.
Create opportunities and collaborations.
And I met, when I came back in 1996, I met the people that would then carry me and introduce me to who I needed to. And I met many, many angels who are still dear in my heart. Carmen, who had a retreat center up in Flagstaff and was doing awakenings, mm-hmm. which was beautiful, beautiful, beautiful work that she was doing there. And I was introduced and met, I would say, my biggest cheerleader of my whole life, and the person that loved me unconditionally, Sister Teresa McIntyre.
Mm.
And she was working at Catholic Charities for many years. She and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, when they were younger, went to England to train with the woman who developed hospice for the world. And you know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and they remained friends many years. And at the end of Elizabeth's life, it was Teresa who took care of her.
Wow.
Until she died.
That's amazing.
Yes.
You had direct connections to a lot of really beautiful teachers that yes. I've read about over the years yes. or even met, but brief.
Yes. Teresa, Sister Teresa, I called her Teresa. She, I don't know how old she was, but she was doing, she was associated with the American Academy of Bereavement, with the newly formed Association for Deaf Education and Counseling. So they were the first accrediting board in thanatology
wow.
in the country and maybe even in the world. I don't know that piece.
What does thanatology stand for?
It's the study of Thanos is death, mm-hmm. the study yep. of, but the field, yep. it is a field. Yep. It is a study of death, dying, grief, loss, and bereavement.
And it wasn't really a field until right around what years?
Right around the rise of hospice and of hospice.
When did that emerge? Do you know?
I'd say in the 70s, you know, really kind of to come up. There's, but Stephen Levine, yep. Beautiful people, Joan Halifax, so many people had already, yeah. you know, begun that work.
It's amazing.
But I did meet Stephen and his wife, Andrea, and one of my beautiful, beautiful teachers and heart loves that I met in, even though I had read, is Andrew Harvey,
mm-hmm.
who's a Rumi scholar.
Amazing.
But I met Andrew, and he was friends with a friend of mine, and so socially we had many conversations together. And then I asked him if he would be my spiritual advisor. So I went to Andrew
wow.
for spiritual nurturing.
Amazing.
And what he taught me blew open my heart. Blew open my heart. He's dearly in my heart, Andrew.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You've had quite a cool life. And we haven't even nicked the surface of all your experiences. That's the beauty of it.
I mean...
And the time even with Stan Grof, we haven't even touched any of that. But you spent a lot of time with that,
yes.
right?
I spent a lot of time carving away everything that was unimportant.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about all of my encounters. You know, that beautiful story, I think it's attributed to Michelangelo about his sculptures and the angels thing.
Yeah.
But the story that I know and that I love is a story from, I believe, India, where there's a man walking along a dusty road, and he comes upon an elder sitting under a tree carving. Mm. And he walks up to the elder, and in front of him are completed elephants. And he's, you know, whittling. And so the man that was walking says to him, picks them up one by one and is looking at them. And he goes, oh, these are extraordinary. How do you do this? And he says, that's easy. I just carve away everything that isn't elephant.
That's cool.
That is one of the defining stories of my life, especially in, I would say, the last 10 years.
And so do you consider it a bit of unprogramming and unlearning
yes.
your conditioning and your cultural indoctrinations and all the stuff that's messy and mind-oriented yeah. and getting back to the essence of being in your heart-centered consciousness?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I'm thinking, but I'm also like, this is what she stands
for. I am
for.
Carving away everything that isn't Barbara Joy. Barbara Joy was my given name, my first and middle name, and then I had my father's name. I had two husbands. After, you know, I had names that
came in
were placed upon me, and that yeah. I chose to rename myself
mm-hmm.
At the time. But I had been divorced for 12 years, and I always loved my name. I didn't want it to be shortened. I didn't want to be a Barb.
Yeah.
That felt very sharp to me. I loved my name, always loved my name. And when I moved to San Francisco, the first thing I did was I went to court and I made Joy my legal last name.
Cool.
And I created a birth announcement because that was the birth of the authenticity of me. And it was my first time alone without a parent, a husband, or a child in my existence.
Wow.
At age 47.
Amazing.
Yes.
So it was a new rebirth of your
yes.
true self, I guess.
Yes. And that, are we doing that? The alien piece of it was a message from my mother.
Tell me about this alien piece.
So I always felt different than those around me, but I knew my place because they told me that. But that wasn't really my place.
Who told you that?
Well, like each of them, my father, you know, sort of declared who I was to be.
Okay.
And who I was to be to my father when he came back from the war. My father was very creative. He was an artist. He made projects. He was Mr. Tool Guy. He was a scientist. He was a musician. He was many things. Mm-hmm. But he made it clear when he came back, because my brother kind of didn't bond with him. Here I am. I'm going to be the project. So he declared that I was his project.
Interesting.
So even though I was introduced in many things, they were my father's things.
Yep. He wanted to like create you.
Yes, in his image.
Yeah.
My mother was a dancer. So I was in dance at 2 years old. I danced in the Chicago Civic Opera House at 4.
Wow.
It was in my mother's image. And not only, which was a theme for my life, is I looked exactly like my mother. I have pictures. It'll blow your mind.
Yeah.
But I always felt in the shadow of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Not my mother's child, but my mother's mother, to care for her. Because her message to me was, you're the only reason I'm living.
Wow. That's powerful to
put
out to a
powerful.
Child.
You're the only reason I'm living. And so good girl me knew that I had to do everything to please my mother.
To keep her alive.
To keep her alive.
That's a powerful testimony.
And how that came out later, how that came true later, and all these things came true later. My father's secondary message was, you can do anything. But what I discovered was, it was as long as it was what he wanted me to do.
Right.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to, like, I think my primal story and what I chose in this lifetime, and I think has been the most influence. That I chose to incarnate in this life as a female. And that has been the defining outer socially and how that has affected me and inner spiritually. So the outer socially, being born in the 40s.
Yeah.
All the impact of that.
Yeah.
And even today, what it means to be a female in a patriarchal society.
Yeah. I don't know what that's like, but I can from the outside go, wow, it's definitely a different world for.
It is totally alien to who I am and my spiritual nature.
Right.
So my entire life of the outside human part has been alien to who I am in the inside. But the inside knowing of having chosen to be a female is my little secret and has always been my little secret. And even before I physically could conceive, if that was going to happen, I always knew that I came here with a little secret, a gift from God that was just mine, that I had the capacity and the potential to conceive and grow a human being inside my body.
It's amazing.
And that has been my spiritual gift. And that has been what has brought me to God.
It's amazing. It's powerful. I can't even wrap my head around it still, the idea of birth and how uh-huh. incredibly complex and interesting and mysterious it still is. Oh. And we just blow it off as like we take it for granted to grow a human inside of you. And to...
I have never taken it for granted.
No, but I just feel like we as a culture.
Oh, as a culture.
Certain I do.
Oh, totally.
And I've never been able to wrap my head around it. Yeah. Still, but yeah. It blows my mind.
But I always knew that. And when my father would say, you can do anything, but the outside world really didn't do that, I'm sitting there going, yeah, I can do anything. If I can do that, I can do anything. And that was the power and the fuel that took me through all kinds of really hard life experiences and good life experiences. I mean, yeah. That is my superpower.
How old were you when you first had your son?
My daughter was first.
Oh, your daughter was first.
And my first marriage.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you then?
I had just turned 22, but I was 21 when I got pregnant.
Yep.
And her father, we were young. Her father left when she was three. So we had been married 4 years.
Yeah.
And basically did not come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I raised her from the time she was three. I remarried a year and a half later. And then Ryan he had not had children and had been married for 14 years and wanted to have a child. We wanted to have a child together, mm-hmm. but we didn't. And for many, many years. By that time, the marriage had really deteriorated by the time Ryan was born. And I needed to leave that marriage.
Yep.
It wasn't healthy. And
which took a lot of courage on both, right? Like most.
So I had, when I moved from North Carolina back to Arizona, because my mom and stepdad had moved here from Chicago. So this was my core home, mm-hmm. my mother, my stepdad. I had a 2-year-old and a 14-year-old.
Wow. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And doing it alone.
And I did it, you know, so my daughter left for college 4 years later. And it was my son and I from the time he was six.
Wow.
Just the two of us.
And were you working full-time too, doing all
Always.
That?
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
So the other big story of my life is my relationship with my mother, which is quite intense and complicated. And but right before my 40th birthday in 1986, it was April. My daughter was about to graduate in May and go to California to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So she was going to turn 18. My son was just six. My mother went to Chicago for a wedding. And my stepdad and I, and you know, we were home, and we get a call on April 12th that she had sustained a cerebral aneurysm and was barely hanging on. She was in a hospital in Evanston, Illinois, and that we had to come because she wasn't going to make it through the night.
Wow.
So he went first, and I went next, and I left my son and my daughter, my six-year-old and my 17-year-old, and I went because my mother wasn't going to make it through the night.
Jeez.
My mother was in a coma for 6 months. She was never expected to live.
Wow.
And she did. She came out of the coma. She was 3 months in Evanston, and we flew her back to Barrows, and she was 3 months here in Barrows. She sustained major deficits.
Mm-hmm.
It was behind her eye, the aneurysm, and so her eye was closed. We didn't know if she was blind. She was crippled. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
My beautiful mother.
Yeah.
They put a shunt in her head, and so my stepdad, they only lived a mile from me. My stepdad quit his job so he could take care of her. I had just gotten a new job, and I had my son. My daughter had already left. And when my mom came out of the coma, you know, it was very intense with all kinds of therapies, all kinds of operations. 6 months after she came home, my stepdad was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Wow.
So now I'm taking my mother for her therapy, him to Tucson for experimental chemo, whatever.
Full-time mom and then working.
6 months later, he died. Now I have an 8-year-old and my mother.
Jeez.
And that...
When she was living with you?
She wasn't living with me. she was living a mile away. But I had to... Well, she was living with my stepdad, and then I had to figure out now what, you know.
And on a trajectory, was this before or after you'd been learning about hospice and all that cool training? That came later. Or sort of always. It was always sort of immersed.
No. So in June of 88, he died in May, and in June is when I went to my first Omega training.
Okay.
And that started the trajectory and pulled me through. It pulled me through because my son got involved with Omega as well.
Cool. So Omega was a huge role in your life.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
And the ancient teachings, and I, you know, started, which then propelled me to go back to school and get my master's, which then sent me for my PhD and,
yeah,
you know, all these programs. It just was this trajectory.
How long was your mother alive like that? Like you taking care of her? And
so my mom met an angel who was 7 days older than her. And, remember I said I wanted to go to California, go to school?
Mm-hmm.
So my son was 12, and he went to go be with his dad.
Right.
My mother went to live with Mel.
Okay.
And they had been together for a couple of years, but not living together. She had met him, mm-hmm, which allowed me to be able to, because he took care of her.
Yeah, and you trusted him.
Oh,
and
yes.
Knew that he was
good. Oh, my God. He
was. So you could actually surrender. And
yes.
Wow.
So then when I came back in 96, then I took care of both of them.
Amazing.
But they were together until they were 94.
Wow.
And that would have been, I don't know, 2014 or 15. And he had a stroke. My mom was like a child, but a lovely child.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a stroke. And so I moved them into an assisted living for a year. But things had deteriorated so much with my mom. And then I found an exquisite, beautiful group home a couple of miles from my house. Kudos to these angels that were they were like my family, and they took care of my mom.
Wow.
So my mom died in the first 100 days of COVID in June of 2020.
Wow.
She was almost 100.
Wow. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's cool how all those pieces fit together, too, in the perfect timing.
So you're the only reason I'm living? Really kind of came true with the choice to take care of my mother, because after my stepdad died, there was no one. My brother had already died. My daughter was in California.
Yep.
I had no other family here.
So it played itself out.
Yeah.
And you had the right equipment, if you will, or tools and spirit for it. And you just seem like the perfect person to help not only others with this death process, which you've helped probably thousands. I don't know how many, but for your own family is where you really learned the hard lesson.
But, you know, I have to say that it all wasn't, you know, the spiritual glory. I went through many dark nights of the soul for myself.
Yeah.
There were days I woke up and was in a fetal position. I thought, I cannot do this one more day.
Yeah. I can't imagine.
I cannot do this one more day. And when it was all said and done at the end in the last 2 years of my mother's life, it was all healed between us.
Mm-hmm.
It was really beautiful at the end.
That's good. You guys made peace.
We did. She with I, and I, you know, but I always knew that every day it was a spiritual will that I said to myself, I am going to choose this today. As hard as it is, and as sad as it is, and I'm going to choose this one more day.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And not a lot of people get the opportunity to have that approach for many reasons, but you're able to have that approach, that sort of connection to something bigger and your mode of being in service and connection to God, if you will.
Yes.
That driving you. Because that, at the end of the day, you can go into a form of nihilism and hopelessness and depression, and it can crush any soul if you don't have that connection to something bigger than you.
And the tools.
And the tools.
I always, once I
the training
got it when I was working with others, but in my groups, what I asked them to do was to unfold one relationship. This is the process, to unfold one relationship. If I asked them to do a loss graph, I did mine first. If they were going to, you know, do this part of the training, I did mine first. So I always.
You were going through your own work as you're working with others.
Yes. And that came in really handy when I was diagnosed with cancer the first time in 1999, because I was doing grief groups, and I just, you know, they were my support.
Amazing.
I went every day after radiation. I would go and do a group, and they would support me, and I would support them, and it was really quite beautiful.
So cool. That the ability to be vulnerable with others is powerful. Mm-hmm. It's rare. And you were in sounds like always in some form of community or learning.
Yes.
Connecting to others that were in that realm. Just powerful. Not a lot of people could do that. I know a lot of isolated people, and as a first responder, I've seen you go into homes, many homes, to the point where you're like, oh, these are dimensions, right? Mm-hmm. And they're dense. Mm-hmm. And it's like people that didn't have any of your, I always recognize it like, geez, I'm lucky. You know, like to not have been abused and hurt or born into a body or a genetic scenario or whatever, to where you're just not able to have a good outcome. And then it compounds, especially in the wrong environments. And I'm sure you've seen so many horrific situations too. You know, family members and people that have come from so many different backgrounds. And it really just builds your capacity, I imagine, to have empathy and to love these people even more, because you have been gifted with a certain form of consciousness and programming and environment and all the things that have given you more opportunity to be you. And so you have a big, not burden, but obligation, which is a weird word, but I've always felt like obligation is a good thing.
Yes.
Because that drives you.
That's like, how I feel about the word responsibility.
Responsibility. Your ability to respond is higher than some.
Yes.
So that's amazing. But it's a burden. It can take a lot of... sounds like you've had quite the load on your shoulders for this lifetime.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of respect I have for you. You know, I knew that when I met you, but it's fun to start to get a higher resolution map. Because first it's low resolution. Like, this is a big thing, you know, here happening. And then I love to be curious and go into people's consciousness, because it is curious. Like, how the heck did you get here? So I appreciate this. This is fun. I am curious to ask you if you ponder this, or if you've ever pondered this. I'm sure you have, being in the death field. What's the term you guys use for the study of dying?
Thanatology.
Thanatology. I'm surprised I've never come across it. And also, I'm curious, do you know Stephen Jenkinson?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know him, but I've
seen his
work. I'm familiar with him.
Cool.
Yes.
Recently, I feel like when Howard lived here and I was helping him with his dying process, I was reading his work, and he was on a book tour, and it came into my life at the perfect time where I was like, oh, death, this whole, I sort of went through life without thinking about it. And it all came in really fast, where I had to, you know, figure out how to relate to death. And Stephen, I read a few of his books. I really liked the way he approached it and his languaging. And I was like, I've never heard anyone speak like this. And what's interesting is I just recently went on a little journey up to Boulder and worked with his sister.
Oh.
Who, I didn't even know this at the time, but she helped me with all that process. Amazing resource. She's been working in this field for her whole life. And it's like, geez, what a crazy, I take on this challenge, but God brings in the most resourceful, capable person to help me through that. She could see every dimension of what was happening to every person in that scenario and help everyone get through it with such a stability. I'm like, how did she do that? And then I went to her training called Full Circle Training, and it's all about death and dying. And beautiful 8-hour workshops every day. And it's just interesting how you've come into my life, she's come into my life, Howard come into my life, and Stephen, and these different authors. And, you know, I've been seeing people die for years, but the way we do it in this culture is just not healthy.
Yes.
And the way we approach death is sort of death phobia, right? Like, we're afraid to talk about it. Mm-hmm. It happens. It's just not a healthy thing.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious right now in the beginning phase at 42, which is like I'm coming into a new chapter of curiosity. And it sure is powerful towards death and understanding it. So it leads me to the question I was going to ask you, which is something you've probably pondered quite often, is if you could say something, if you were to die today, I like to think tonight, you're going to be gone. What would you want to say to people if they were to hear you? It could be young, it could be old people, it could be the whole planet. But say it was something that was going to outlive you. You know, it's the most powerful question, I almost think, is like, what would you want to say to the world if you were going to die? And you may not even know in this moment, but I'm curious.
Huh.
But really, you can even take it in and really just, what is it?
Two words came, and it just came like, you know, a little sign. So I'll say that what it said on the little sign. Love abounds.
Love abounds. Cool. And what does that mean to you when you see it or feel it? Or
that God is in everything.
And that probably gives you a feeling of faith, like a little surrender and trust, which alleviates the whole I need to worry and fear and all the stuff that causes dis-ease.
I do worry and I fear.
Sure.
And I do have disease.
Mm-hmm.
And in my core, I know, I feel God is in all things.
Beautiful. I love that. It's a beautiful thing to say to people. And a reminder from someone that's been through and walked the walk, and you're still going through, and you have many more challenges to come. I'm sure people that you love that are still going to have to die, and our own suffering, our own deterioration of our own mortality. It's things that most people avoid. You've actually walked it and went into it with ferocity in a way.
When I would do a breath work, I have my little favorite one that I have presented at in every meeting, in every talk. If there's 100 people, 200 people, I'll take through a little 5-minute breath exercise. And I've been doing this for many, many years, 40, 50 years.
Mm.
And I would say at the end of the breath exercise, I would say to them, where do you think death lives? So I'll ask you that question, Ryan. We already did our little breath work. Where do you think death lives?
To me, the first thing that comes, because this is the way I view death, is that it's moment to moment. This moment is a death. Every moment is somewhat of an existential death. So that keeps me wanting to hone in. Mm-hmm. And it makes me want to be in this presence. And it makes me want to be at the firehouse before it's over, that chopping the vegetables with the guys. And it's a death. Bella, my dog, when she was with me, it made me think that these are the moments. So I would look at her for 10 straight minutes and we would just gaze and we'd go through that beautiful. Sometimes I'd tear up and cry with her and we'd vibrate, you know. Howard, when he lived here, it was like he was a ghost already and I could be with him because of death. You know what I mean? So to me, it's like this is it. And that's what death is. But I'm curious what you would, you've seen many answers and you probably have an answer. What is
so yours? You asked me that question.
Yeah. So what, how did
where you, do you, where do I where
do you think
death
lives? Yeah.
I think death lives in the pause between the breath that goes out and the one that doesn't come in. So in that pause, death waits. Every exhale, there's death. If you breathe in, then you have that moment of life.
Beautiful.
And so I've carried that sort of with equanimity. I'm, you know, neither good or bad, right or wrong, but it has absolutely fueled me in a way, as you're speaking in your words, to know that this might be the last moment of my life, and I'll use myself, that in this moment, this gift of being with you and sharing this living moment is the most precious thing we can give each other, is time and being together. Like, that's where it is. Yeah. That's where life is. And death is waiting in the pause, and we have no idea.
Yeah, it's lurking.
Just waiting. Yeah. I don't know. For me,
lurking sounds a little creepy.
Well, yeah, on Halloween, yeah. I think it's appropriate. I have so many skull pants. I love skulls. I collect them, and I have, like, skull pants. Oh, I love to wear my skull pants. Cool. I almost wore them today.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I meditate on death in a beautiful way, too.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of people say, oh, that's dark. Even this, at breakfast this morning, this girl, Lindsay, who owns the coffee shop, sweet lady, she goes, I listened to your podcast, and I go, yeah, it was my first one because I just released one. And I go, you know what inspired it? Because we're all going to be dead soon. And I want to start capturing the essence of people and share it. So that inspired me to buy the equipment. And she goes, wow, that's a little dark. And it's like, well, not to me. Mm-hmm. It's not dark. It's amazing.
Yes.
Because death isn't something to fear. It's just something to be curious about.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that makes us different as a species. Mm-hmm. This is what drives humanity. Mm-hmm. It makes the music, the art, the war, the suffering, the neurosis. It is the underbelly, I think. Mm-hmm. And so meeting people like you that study death, and it's cool that I'm meeting people like you, the more I get curious about it, it truly magnetizes, mm-hmm. just like with anything. As soon as you look for a Nissan Sentry,
sure.
everywhere.
That's right.
But I have this beautiful appreciation for meeting people like you and Sanchi Retta and Don Howard.
Mm-hmm.
He taught me about death through sacred plants, mm-hmm. and it was not easy, and it was beautiful, and it was a whole different version that I couldn't have learned in mm-hmm. a book. And seeing death, when I first got hired on the fire department, seeing my first death, mm-hmm. like physical, whoa, I didn't know I was going to, mm-hmm. how you deal with that is up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a fascinating way to think about things, and I have a lot to learn from people like you, because you have so many resources and things you've picked up on and spent so much time with people going through that phase.
I have.
And that's just like, you can't learn that in books.
No.
You know?
No.
It's just you have to learn through experience.
And... yes. I think I used to say back 40 years ago, when I went into Omega, we had to fill out this little thing. It was like stem sentences, like it would be the beginning words and then you fill in the blank. And I remember, I found it, and it was like from the 80s.
Cool.
And I think this, you know, how would you describe? I describe myself as a, and then I put experiential astronaut.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I always have felt that.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Give me the experience. I just want to do it.
Yeah.
And I have done, I cannot even believe some of the stuff that I've done.
Yeah. And the learning just makes it all get bigger.
Yeah. And travel. Travel is a beautiful thing.
It's the biggest way to expand, isn't it?
I've been halfway around the world.
Amazing.
And it's just opened my every vista. Every vista. It's just amazing to travel.
I think travel must be the biggest way to get out of your own stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when people I see are suffering, I've had cousins that have been addicted or family members, mm-hmm. and I always think the best thing you could do if you could muster up the courage would be to sell everything if you had to, or do what you had to do to get out of your realm of patterns
mm-hmm.
and novelty,
mm-hmm.
cultures, and you could go to any country. It doesn't matter where, land there, and it takes you so far out of your normal state
yes.
that you have to survive, first of all. There's no time to self-deprecate.
Uh-huh.
And you have to immerse, and it's going to expand, and then you connect, and you learn, and it's so important.
It's
even
a beautiful
thing. Even if it's within the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, with our country.
Well, yes, because our country is so
many,
diverse.
Yeah, it's like many countries,
yes.
right? It's like Europe, almost,
yes.
but with state lines.
And, yes.
So, yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a huge thing to help people understand if you're young and you're like, I don't know what to do with my life. It's like, no one does. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't. That's a great answer. I don't know what to do with my life.
I'm going to go back soon and volunteer in hospice. I'm ready to and excited to create space for that.
Cool. Because you just love the feeling of sharing and giving and being
and
of service.
And I've been invited to travel as well. So I'm going to go to Peru in July.
Wow.
And I have some other invitations coming. And
cool. And you just traveled somewhere for a big workshop.
The workshop was here.
Was
but
it here?
I went to Mexico on a spiritual retreat.
Cool.
And in July, I'm going to Peru. I've not been to Peru, Machu Picchu, and
wow.
Many things down the Amazon and
cool
work with the shaman and rituals. And
beautiful.
Yes.
So you never stop. You are still the astronaut.
I am.
Yeah.
I am.
The psychonaut, too.
Well, that's...
That's an inner...
I just received through Amazon both volumes of Stan's new work.
Yeah. I read
his
the first volume of that, The Way of the Psychonaut.
Yeah, I just got it.
Cool. Yeah, he's an amazing writer.
Yes.
His first book that I read was Beyond the Brain.
Yes.
And I love the intro. It's just his ability to go through all the different ways that we related to mm-hmm. human psychology and the different mm-hmm. forms of it. It blew my mind.
I was really blessed because not only the work and the many, many hours, but also at school, not only taking classes, but then, you know, being part of the faculty, you know, like through the registrar's office. And so there's many different roles I've had with Stan. And he is a shaman and a shapeshifter. I've never seen anything like it.
Mm.
He is just profoundly, profoundly.
A genius, too.
Oh, just love that man.
Yeah.
And so blessed because... Before I left San Francisco, I wasn't even finished and hadn't completed his program, but he invited me twice with just him to go and do work in a smaller group. So it was just the two of us.
Wow.
Facilitating breathwork.
That's
in a
incredible.
Smaller group twice. And I hadn't even, I mean, it was just such an honor. And then after I graduated and came back to Phoenix, I was invited twice to staff inside an opening with Jack Kornfield that they've been doing for 28 years now.
Wow.
In Joshua Tree.
How cool.
So I got to participate and staff two of the trainings.
That's
there.
So cool.
Yes.
So you meet Jack Kornfield.
Oh, yes.
Got to hang out with him a
yes,
little bit.
Yes, I got to hang out with him a lot.
Wow. Tell
He's
me
a
about
beautiful
him.
Heart.
I love him. Anytime I feel a little overwhelmed or something, I think of his voice. I've had it in my head
yes.
for years. It's like we have memory where you can hear it crystal clear, anyone's voice, anytime you want, if you truly believe mm-hmm. you can. Just close your eyes and do it.
Yeah.
And I always hear him come and go, now, right? And like his calm, incredible, because he can take in the macro so well,
uh-huh.
the existential crisis that we're in and the planet and... And then he comes in with just...
There's a kindness to that man. That's just...
I would love to meet him.
Oh, yeah. He's just a beautiful, beautiful soul. So in the staffing, what I got to do is participate. So every morning, the first part of the day is silent meditation with Jack, and then lunch, and then breath work every day.
Wow.
And then at night...
How many people in these groups?
A lot.
Yeah, hundreds.
Yeah,
okay.
A lot of people. But as a staff person, I participated in the meditation, but I staffed the breath work.
Yeah, how so, cool.
Yeah, I was a facilitator of the breath work, and that was...
And was it holotropic?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always the holotropic you were
yes.
facilitating.
Yeah.
And these were going on for hours, two-hour sessions, big ones.
Oh.
3 hours.
They went on for days. Sometimes we had to take shifts because people were 24 hours
of breathing coming in and out.
So we would take and sit with them. I would say that,
jeez.
You know, I mean, the insight of and the work of doing the breath work is profound in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But the sitter is what prepared me more than anything to do the grief work when I came back.
Amazing.
That is like my sweet spot. I can sit. I can be in silence. I can breathe. Mm-hmm. Just watching, mm-hmm. attending. That's my sweet spot. And that just was such a beautiful, maybe the most beautiful part of the whole thing for me.
The sitter as the breathwork facilitator.
As the sitter.
Amazing.
To be the sitter.
Mm-hmm. I've gotten to do that too in his workshops, two of his and then many mm-hmm. others, but it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And then to witness other people's transformations happening, and it's weird how you're weeping and they're weeping, but it's just all so powerful. And people go, breathwork, you know, from the outside looking in, it doesn't make sense, but it's the most powerful tool of healing.
I think so.
100%.
It's not that I think so.
You know it.
I know.
Yeah, you've had it. You've seen it.
You know, if I had any doubts about an inner healer, that was just blown out of the water.
Yeah.
And I have Stan to thank for that. It was his guidance and his, you know, soul that brought that forward to the world and made it viable and livable for me.
Yeah.
And I could only speak for myself.
He took it from like a abstract concept from the Eastern philosophies mm-hmm. that had been around forever, but brought it to the West.
Yes.
And it was almost a good thing that drugs became illegal. The war on drugs created that.
Yes.
It would have never happened, maybe. So what an interesting turn of events.
Yes.
As horrible as the war on drugs is.
But just coming around full circle now with using psychedelics.
For healing.
And it'll come back.
Sure.
It'll come back. It's all...
Yeah.
It's all a cycle.
And it's like people always find new ways of, like he did, he pivoted. Mm-hmm. He didn't just go, I'm a victim. Oh, no, it's over. He goes, well, how can I? Because he was already doing that mm-hmm. inner work.
Yes.
And that transpersonal type psychology. It's like I think in 100 years, people are going to look back at his work as some of the basis for
Absolutely.
The future. He's just a little ahead of his time
mm-hmm.
and not fully recognized for his beauty yet. Even though you go to the MAPS conference, there's a line wrapped around the building for him because he was standing there. It's like the last time he'll probably ever travel. Yeah. But
you know, I want to include the tribe, which are all these people who have come before. And you know, we're part of that too, that are moving forward to transform, be the light bringers and the light shiners on our little piece and adding it to the mix.
Yeah.
So many angels.
Good people out there.
So many angels.
Yep.
I'm very hopeful.
Yeah. You can always look back through history and there's always been helpers.
Yes.
You know, and there's always been tyrants and all the others. So,
you know, and, you know, the idea of a prophet, which is in many religions, you know, the idea of a prophet. I see God coming out of people's mouths, sometimes in color, sometimes in... So yesterday I went to Unity for a service, and this beautiful, beautiful soul, Jimmy, does a beautiful meditation.
Mm.
And when he spoke yesterday, because I keep my eyes open. I'm not an eye closer anymore because there's no inner and outer. I mean, to me, it's just all one. I was watching God's words coming out of his mouth, and it was like honey coming out of a honeycomb. I literally could see like the words were like honey. And I told him afterwards, and I'm like, oh, your words are honey.
That's cool.
And that's why I keep my eyes open, because I know that God's not just inside me, so I don't have to close my eyes to see God.
Sure.
This is where I see God.
That's amazing. I like your other statement, too, about it's in everything.
Yeah.
It's not like it's a deity in the sky looking over you with judgment, or it's a unfolding manifestation of all things.
And it's interesting that I used the God word, because I use the word. Now, I don't like pick and choose, and in that moment, God came out. Mm. But it could be any word.
Yeah. It's hard to put that into a word, isn't it?
But we have to in order to communicate. And I get that, and I understand, like Tower of Babel. I get that. But in order to communicate, we use words.
Yep.
I just don't hold any energy in words.
Yeah. You look at the map, and then it goes away.
I just feel the impulse behind the words, the intention. I feel the energy behind the words, not actually the label.
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. It's not as easy to do in our culture, too, because we're taught with our minds how to use language in a certain way.
And everyone takes on, of course, everyone has a different, absolutely unique meaning, because we're all unique with our experiences and things like that. So in doing grief work, to get people to apply, which I think is the highest spiritual principle next to love, is forgiveness. When I know that that's what we're doing, but so many people would revolt because they had a definition of forgiveness that kept them stuck. Mm-hmm. So we would invent a new word or a new sentence so that they didn't have to use the forgive word in order for them to unblock enough to be able to apply the principle.
Give me an example of a word or a way you would do that with a certain particular person.
Okay. So say somebody is unfolding a relationship that was challenging or hard or abusive. I don't want to pick the thing.
Sure.
And they're like, I'm never forgiving that person.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay. So it's like you resentment, the resentment that you're holding or shame or guilt or pain or whatever you're holding is like taking poison and hoping the other person dies.
You taking it and poisoning yourself.
You taking poison.
Yep.
This is what's happening when you hold that energy.
Yep. You're at dis-ease.
You are taking poison and hoping the other person dies by a definition.
Yep.
That isn't serving you, and that's your block. You can go no further as long as you define it that way.
Yeah.
So let's take the telescope that's looking at the mountain, same telescope, but just look at a different peak.
Yep. And what's the new peak? Give me
the new peak is this, and I could help them choose it. I love myself so much that I am not going to hold this pain and poison myself.
I love that.
That's forgiveness.
Perfect.
And once they get that it's all about love, that forgiveness is an act of self-compassion. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the other person.
Sure.
It doesn't mean you condone. It doesn't mean you forget. It doesn't mean you have to be in relationship with that person. Mm-hmm. What it means is you love yourself so much that you'll move heaven and earth in the love for yourself. You'll move heaven and earth, even getting over a definition that hasn't served you.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
See, this is where your power comes through, is doing that with individuals. Yeah, you're in your flow.
Yes.
And I like that.
Yeah.
Because I can see that you've said that 100. How many times do you think?
A million times.
Yeah, a million times.
But
and
you know,
so powerful.
I have had to say it to myself a million times. Sure. But that, again, is what I understand. Unless I bring in the spiritual dimension, it's like a New Year's resolution. You know, you have an awareness, which is intellectual. Okay, I know there's a problem here. I have a problem here. Then the emotional piece says, ooh, it doesn't feel good, and I feel like I have to do something about it. And then in our culture, or in maybe science, we're taught there's a straight line between cause and effect, or between the event and the response. There's a straight line.
Right.
An event happens and then you respond.
Right.
But it's not a straight line. And the missing piece is what keeps us fractured. And until we understand the missing piece, we cannot move towards wholeness, holotropic, moving towards wholeness or holiness.
Yep.
And that's the missing piece. So it's like, wow, I know I have a problem. I feel really bad about it, and I want it to change because it's hurting me.
Yep.
Stopping smoking or not putting a potato chip on the, you know, that's the response.
Right.
That's physical.
Sure. But there's a deeper.
So what's missing is will. And I'm spiritual will, which says this. I love myself so much that I will heaven and earth to make a change. And then you make the change and you're golden. Or I'm golden.
Yeah.
To speak for myself. I'm golden.
Yeah.
When I move heaven and earth, because I love myself so much, And sometimes it takes me a lot and maybe years and many years to get to that point for that thing.
Yeah.
But when I do, I'm golden.
And there's a deep sort of trust once you give it to something bigger too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's what the root of people's lack of ability to get out of holes or pain or of all of us is when we feel that you lose trust or you forget the bigger thing.
Yes.
The thing Viktor Frankl talked about, the Holocaust, or some of the people like in prison camps and things of that. It's like, geez, how did they get through that? Well, it always came from the will to meaning or the will.
Yes.
And that's a powerful subject. It could go on. I could study that for the rest of my life and be still itching at it, inching at it. And it's the biggest stuff to read and think about and conceive of because it's coming.
And then it is a redefinition because people can define willpower as, well, you know, it's genetic, it's this, and, you know, it's whatever. But there is willpower.
Oh, yeah.
And we can employ it.
You hear even like Sapolsky now, his book Almost to Destroy Will. He's a very brilliant man. Mm-hmm. He's at Stanford and he wrote a recent book. I can't remember the title, but basically like most Western scientists right now, the new religion is to eliminate the idea that will exists, right? Like, because we don't want will because then we have to take responsibility for our lives. And it's unbelievable the amount of data and information that you'll come up with to plunder will away.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, knowing in your deepest self, if you're quiet enough and you sit in nature by yourself or you find, it's like, well, what the hell's going on here? You don't have any will? Well, that's the biggest question,
of course,
is your will.
Yes.
And to ponder that and build a relationship with that curiosity, not knowing how much or how little anyone has and why, could be a great unknown as to how much, how it's a mystery, but you have some. And you're just a giant collection of your patterns of little wills. You can remember moments where I chose to do good or to do bad. And then your response from that, and you're like, oh, I can actually choose. And the breath comes in. Mm-hmm. You can slow down enough to even have a little more awareness to then maybe have a little more subtle choice, listening or paying attention to something bigger than you. Or so it is a fascinating subject, the will. I think it's the most interesting subject.
It's one of the things you said about choice. Omega, the key of Omega is about responsibility. That's like the whole energy of Omega. Who you are in the as an individual, who you are in relationship, that's Omega 2. And Omega 3 is who you are on the planet.
Yeah, taking personal responsibility.
And the whole thing is around responsibility. And I have a beautiful piece that George wrote, and I'm going to send it to you after.
I'd love that.
Because it's really made an impact.
George, the founder of Omega?
Yes.
Cool.
And he wrote this beautiful piece on responsibility and wrote this training around, all, you know, as the lifeblood or the energy behind what the transformation for these trainings. Again, another word that people can... when it's really quite neutral, it's the ability to respond.
Yep.
And we all have the ability to respond. And one of the things that I have really spent a lifetime working on for myself is releasing labels, which are a judgment, and releasing right or wrong, good or bad. So when I look on my past now at the choices, the ways that I've responded, I no longer say, wow, that was, I got myself into, you know, whatever, that was a bad choice or whatever. I have no idea the complexity to the end of eternity of that choice.
Sure.
Changes everything.
Yeah.
So now I say to myself, looking back, on that day, I made that choice.
Move forward.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's neither good or bad, right or wrong. If I look back on that and I said, this is what I did on that day.
Yeah. Does it change your choice in the future when you come across another scenario that's similar? You might choose differently because of it, but you're not dwelling and shaming and guilting over this choice that you made because you can't change it. So you're like, that was what I did that day with my best of my ability, I guess.
Right.
But now I can make a different choice if that presents itself again because of my new awareness.
I think the awareness is not so much, I think the shame and all of that is the aftermath of putting a value of right or wrong, good or bad on the choice. So then what comes out of that is either I'm happy or I'm shamed or I'm guilty or I'm sad or I'm mad or I'm whatever. But if you take away the judgment.
Does shame serve a purpose, though? At some level, we evolved it for a good reason to help us not to continue doing. That's how psychopaths or people that do bad things all the time, not bad, but things that hurt themselves or others.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like if we just blow off shame and guilt as a non-useful signal, then it's like, well, that's actually your signal to go and adjust your behavior patterns. Like if you stole when you're a kid, yes. And you feel that like, oof, it could be a god at the time because that was what you thought it was.
Yes.
It was judging you or your grandma that died.
Uh-huh.
That's what I thought. It was my grandma that was watching me. But at the end of the day, I loved that emotion because I wouldn't steal again because I thought it was my grandma watching
yes.
me. And it held me to a higher standard.
You made meaning.
I made meaning.
You made meaning.
Yeah, like we're meaning makers.
Yeah. I think guilt is an inside recognition that I recognize I did something that needs an apology. I need to make amends. To me, guilt is an inner feeling that arises. Shame comes from the outside. I think shame is placed from the outside in a way.
Yeah.
But how I feel about emotions, that's like one of my most favorite things. When you were a kid, did you love in September when you started school and you got your 64 box of Crayola crayons with the little sharpener? I don't know if you were into that.
I was an anti-school. I think it was always sort of like, oh, great, we're going back to the place where they make you sit for 8 hours.
Oh, I love school. School is my safe place.
It's tough for boys.
Yeah, I guess so.
We're like, you know, we want to run and play, at least for me.
Yeah.
So
well,
prison for
September
me.
Came and I got my box of 64 crayons. And I love to color. And what I discovered inside of myself, and to make a metaphor that I thought worked for me and it really helped a lot of people, I wrote about this too, is that we come into this world loaded with a 64 box of crayons with every color of emotion. Now, some colors we use a lot, and even the paper comes off and it's this little nub and that's mm-hmm. in the bottom of the box. Some we don't use at all. But regardless, they all live together in the box. And that's how it is with human emotions.
Mm-hmm.
God is in all things. We were given these as gifts. We might use them. Maybe we use them a lot. Maybe we don't use them at all. But not to judge that one is better than the other. And once we understand that, we can also move to our heart space and understand that what we choose as a loss is 100% to us, and how we respond to that, which is grief, is the emotional response to loss. Loss is the interchange of a familiar pattern of living or behavior. How often do things interchange? Every second of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And then grief rises up first as an emotional response to that loss. We get to decide what our losses are. And we grieve them at 100%. So in my grief groups, the biggest lesson, day one, in the first 5 seconds, was someone whose child is murdered is sitting next to someone whose house burned down, who's sitting next to someone who was kicked out of their family because of their sexual preference, who is sitting next to someone who lost their job, who's sitting next to someone whose dog died. Okay?
Yep.
And in that first moment, it is, we are all here together to support one another for what our 100%. Oh, wow. It changes everything.
Yeah.
Ryan, it changes everything. To remove judging and comparing.
Yep. The hierarchy of suffering. And
because if your mother died and my mother died, the only thing we have in common,
that's
right off the bat, is the scientific fact of the death of our mother. Every other thing is ours. everything.
Yeah.
You know, and so the job to be a heart with ears, and that was my mascot.
I remember this. Okay.
The heart with ears.
Yeah.
You know, which then said, I will support you and love you because we are here grieving together and sharing a human experience. I will sit next to you. I will listen to you. And then you will listen to me. We will be the living witnesses for each other because all of the grief work, you know, there's a lot of different, you know, and everybody has to choose what works for them.
Sure.
But the idea in the work that I did, which was the Grief Recovery Outreach Program, it's been renamed, but basically that work, John James founded that many, many years ago out of the need for grief support when his son died.
Yeah.
And there was nothing. He was from Canada and he created this beautiful, beautiful program that, you know, that says it's okay to, you know, think of, read a book. I'm not taking that away, or writing a letter or whatever journaling or whatever. But that's still contained in your little piece. Mm-hmm. Until you have a living witness that can hold that, that's where the healing is. Okay. Same thing like with breathwork. It's your sitter. It's your living witness to your transformation, to your experience. It's
powerful.
The most powerful thing.
Which reinforces our need for everyone.
Absolutely.
Others, community.
Absolutely.
Support, vulnerability. Instead of trying to take it alone.
Yes.
And this individuality of culture.
Yes.
Isolation and all that.
Yeah.
That's powerful. I'm seeing, as you're saying this, all the who knows how many countless people that you've had to witness going through some of the craziest things and their ability to try to share that in these spaces. And it had to be an incredible ability of yours to hold that for people. And then to help other people figure out how to hold that for others. What a gift. Yeah. Sounds really interesting.
Yeah. And one of the things that I was a 12-year member of this amazing gift. You know, Medicare is a gift from the government. You know, you can talk all you want about the government, you know, this, that. But the two things that I partnered up with the government was hospice, which is government funded.
Yep.
Beautiful gift.
Yep.
And I was a 12-year member of the National Disaster Team. So the National Disaster Team, originally under Health and Human Services, arose when there were aviation crashes.
Oh.
And the funeral service teamed up with the airlines to create services when there was an airplane crash.
For all the families and all the
people. And so the government took it up under Health and Human Services, and a entity was created called the National Disaster Medical System.
Wow.
So there were five teams. There was search and rescue, medical assistance, veterinary. And the fifth one, I'm not going to remember, but I was a member of the fourth team, which is the mortuary division. So when there was a disaster, we set up the morgues.
Wow.
And we processed. And I became a member in 2000 in enough time to be deployed.
September 11th.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And I was deployed for September 11th. But I was only grief counselor. Everyone else on my team was a blood analyzer, a dentist, you know, for remains. Wow. X-ray technician, medical examiners, coroners,
sure.
Anybody that had to do with dealing with remains.
Wow.
And I was a grief counselor.
So you, with September 11th, were sitting with all the people, the family members, anyone that
I did not get deployed in that way.
Okay.
Everyone else on my team did.
Okay.
Physically.
Yeah.
Went to the three sites, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
New York, because at that time I was a national speaker, and I was speaking all over the United States on issues of grief and loss.
Wow.
My deployment was now to continue that, but to address
this new emergent
this
team
national
kind of response
grief event.
Okay. So what did that entail? What did that look like?
So I continue, you know, so I would go from city to city. I went to 130 cities. I spoke in a 7-hour seminar.
Oh my gosh.
Uh-huh.
How interesting.
And 3 years I did that. But then when Katrina hit in, I'm going to say 5 or 6, I can't remember what year it was, I was physically deployed. And we had our New Orleans, which was our largest contingency, set up the morgues there. And then I was in Mississippi, which was the smaller contingency. But I was deployed in October. So it happened the very, very end of August. And I came in October for a month. And that was heart-shattering and exhilarating. Hmm. It was the most amazing thing. The resilience and the generosity and the kindness. And yet there were dark things, many dark things about that. To be in the, everything was gone. The base was set up in a water park,
wow.
You know, with the water slides. In one was Gulfport and one was Biloxi, and I can't remember which is which, mm-hmm. but the base was in one, but there were 5 of us that were in family service. And so we got shipped out every single day to the coroner's office. And I think it would have been Gulfport. I don't know, whatever the capital is. And we worked there in conjunction with the coroner. The bodies that were found, we had people come in and we did DNA to try to match up bodies to family members. But the biggest part of my job, and this is like from a science fiction story because it's like beyond belief, but you know, in like New Orleans, the graves are above ground. So when there's flooding,
oh my gosh.
So in Mississippi, there were,
oh wow,
there were all of these caskets had been blown into trees.
Wow.
And bodies and out of niches. There were 1,300 bodies.
Wow. That's crazy.
And this is like unbelievable what this job is I had all the records from the mortuaries were gone. So no one knew who was buried where, who was there to match up these bodies that had come from not new deaths.
Yeah.
All these bodies that had been washed up and,
jeez. You know,
like debris.
That's a complex scenario.
And so to call, my gosh, to call a family and say, what was in the casket? Was there a little bunny or something with you? What was your child wearing when they, I mean.
Gosh. And that's amazing that field was created in your lifetime, and then you get to be such a part of it.
Yes.
And then when you say something as simple as like we set up a morgue, it's like, let's breeze over that. But that had to take incredible amount of effort and delegation.
To be on the team for the 12 years I was on the team, I spent probably 40 hours of study, just at home study, almost like a degree study.
Wow.
Every year, because we had to train physically and intellectually in every one of the 5 fields. So I learned how biohazard, how to respond, how to make a litter, how to, and every year we went for a big training where we were taught mm-hmm. how to search and rescue, how to take pictures, to put the little number, mm-hmm.
And then that field now has just progressed exponentially? Or how is that now?
It's still in existence. I'm not a member of the team anymore.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like sophisticated and better, or if it sort of deteriorates, or how.
Well,
it's as far as...
a dear, dear, dear friend of mine is still on the team. Those of us that are older, she's younger, 20 years younger than me. So she's still on the team. So she just got deployed to Hawaii for the fires.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So she still gets deployed for that, you know. So I don't, you know, I haven't kept up with it.
Yeah. Because you move on, like you were saying earlier before we even started the podcast, you learn. You serve, and then once you feel like you've planted enough seeds or done your work yes. there, you move to another place and you advance your learning and expand. And it seems like you've done that a lot.
I created a seminar that I presented one time. It took me 2 years after Katrina. When I first arrived there, I get off the plane, and there was a group of us for that deployment, and they immediately put us in a bus and took us on a tour of the 26 miles lengthwise and 5 miles in of destruction.
Jeez.
It was like nothing you could even imagine.
Were you in boats doing this, or how did it?
We went on along the river.
Mm-hmm. Jeez.
There was nothing. There were no birds. The trees were all dead. There was nothing, nothing, nothing. There was a barge. They used to have casinos and barges on the river, and there'd be this barge that weighs like a gazillion tons that was 10 miles all crazy.
Wow, it's amazing.
Next to a little child swing set from Sears that was still in the spot.
Crazy.
But everything else was gone. I mean, it was so you want to talk about it. Otherworldly experience.
Yeah.
And then on the day we left, because we worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we were in one of those barges. At first, the first month, they were in refrigerated cars.
Wow.
That's where the team was, in refrigerated cars.
Jeez.
And then they moved us to a barge.
And there's no showers, no the living conditions.
Oh, and first four had been, you know, underwater, so we had to get up. There was no water. We had to bring in our own water, even in October for my deployment.
Sure.
We had to bring in all the water.
Jeez. It's crazy.
It was. And then on the last day, they took us again so that we wouldn't forget that we were going home to our homes and our families, and there was nothing. It was nothing. We were not allowed to take pictures, but they gave us later. They sent us like not a CD, but with pictures on it, like 2,000 pictures.
Yeah.
It took me 2 years before I could ever look at it.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 2 years, when I had come to some peace in my heart, I created a seminar called Numbers, and I only presented it one time. I was working in hospice, and to my team, I asked them for permission if they would. They were my living witnesses because this was my grief work.
Yep, you needed to do it to heal and to feel
and
clear.
One of the beautiful angels that was sitting there listening to me, with a pencil on the back of her, because I had a handout book, with a pencil, drew a picture of me like a portrait with one tear coming down.
Wow.
Which is the eye of God with the tear.
With all of humanity.
And here that came through in 2005 in another way.
Yeah.
Like these themes from our lives, Ryan, when we open up to the beauty of it and the transformation of it, it transforms into something so meaningful. And so beautiful. Yeah.
Dang. Thank you for sharing some of this stuff. This is cool. I mean, it's heavy stuff.
It
but
is.
It's beautiful. That's the depth of who you are. And that's, it's just filled.
With the name of Joy.
Yeah.
That's the lightness.
I knew when I met you. I was like, God, you have a lot to unpack. You know, you've just lived such a life, and it's just nice to get more layers of the map.
Yeah.
It's so cool. It's so much. I mean, it's like, I still know that we've barely even nicked the surface, which is so cool. But
what an honor.
No, thank you. Here. This is beautiful. It's nice to just talk and share and explore consciousness together and connect with a nice human like you. So maybe we'll wrap it up. And is there anything you'd want to say other than what you've said so far?
It's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful
day. It is a beautiful
day. To be alive.
Yeah, it is a beautiful day.
Right on.
I'm very grateful.
Me too. Thank you. Grateful to know you and for this time we shared today together. It was fun and there's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the episode. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Spotify, YouTube, and iTunes and rate the show. I hope you enjoyed the episode.